Well, thanks, guys, for all your wonderful questions. Several of you asked me about my process and resources and sort of how I moved from study to presentation. And I just wanted to show you something over here. I'm going to sit right here real quick. Can you guys still hear me okay? All right, so one thing that I utilize that I just wanted to make sure you know is available to you. This is the website BibleGateway.com, which I'm sure you all know. And when you go to resources, so here you are at the homepage, and you click on study, and then more resources, and you scroll down to dictionaries, encyclopedia, okay? Then there's all these different items here. One of them is the Dictionary of Bible Themes. I don't know if everyone can see this or not, but and then there's all these different main header categories. Under God, look at all of these different items. And here is Theophany. And so one thing that I did in my study was went through all these passages, every single one. And there's main categories there. And then it's all kind of cross-referenced with other items. But honestly, just about every biblical theme that you could think of is in that Dictionary of Bible Themes. So that's a great resource for you on any topic that you're studying that's right there online. And then another resource that I have really benefited from is a podcast called Help Me Teach the Bible with Nancy Guthrie. Who's already using this? Anyone? It's an excellent, excellent podcast. She interviews lots of different seminary professors and teachers, some men, some women. But it's one that I really like. So, and you can kind of go through the archives and see if there's one on your book. Just wanted to make that available to you. Okay, I did have a few questions about the nature of Jesus as a theophany. So let me read this one. I wondered whether calling Jesus a permanent theophany was not glorious enough for the mystery of the incarnation. He is more than a manifestation of the presence and glory of God. He is fully God and fully man. It's an excellent question, and I would just say yes, that Jesus is a theophany in the sense that he's an appearance of God, but it's a very unique appearance, obviously. It's a different type of appearance than the previous provisional and temporary theophanies that went before. And I have a quote from Vern Poitras' book that says a little bit more about this, that explains a little bit more. He said, we can use this word theophany more narrowly or more broadly. In a broader use, it would encompass not only obvious instances describing an appearance of God, but also appearances that are more veiled, as when God appears as a cloud and no one can see inside the cloud. A broad use would also include appearances of God in the New Testament, including the appearance of Christ himself. In his incarnation, Christ is the permanent theophany of God. So maybe that's helpful to think about it that way, narrow sense, broad sense. In a broad sense, we're talking about the presence of God. In a narrow sense, this visible manifestation. And again, I think it's important to differentiate between Jesus and everything not Jesus. Does that make sense? Any like further questions about that, or is that helpful? Okay, that was similar, Kelly, to the question that you asked me. Hopefully that clears it up a little bit. I mean, also too, I'll just say, we're talking about something that's actually, you know, the hypostatic union. We've done our best as a people to give language to this over the centuries in the Christian faith, but it's still ultimately something very mysterious. How can God be fully God and fully man at the same time? We can't actually explain it. We can only affirm it to the best of our ability. Okay, you mentioned that theophanies were usually associated with establishment or ratification of God's covenant. Can you please further elaborate on how the theophany that appeared to Manoah and his wife was related to God's covenant with either Israel and or with the Son of God? So I think in the book of Judges, what we have is a time when God's people were not keeping covenant. So the theophanic appearances, and there's two in the book of Judges. There's the one we covered in chapter 13, and there's also the one to Gideon. They're really serving to call the people back to the covenant. So it's a period of time between the Mosaic covenant and the Davidic covenant. So there's not a new covenant happening, but it's encouraging God's people to come back to the covenant with these cycles, you know, showing the people over and over and over again that they're essentially lost without God. So that's what I would say about that. There are many appearances of the angels in the Old Testament. What are some guidelines to distinguish the actual angels from the theophanies? So here, I think context is really helpful. Noticing what are these angels, or is this angel doing? Where are they going? Where have they come from? What's happening around them? To me, the biggest clue, the biggest help, is when there's an element or an act of worship, and that worship is received. When in Judges chapter 13, when Manoah says, "Will you stay and eat a meal?" and he says, "No, but you can do a burnt offering," that's a good clue. Like, okay, we are dealing with something divine here. So usually when you have people falling on their face, you know, and the angel of the Lord is receiving that, then we know that we're dealing with God. Does that make sense? Okay. Also, in that Poythress book, which is on the table over here, if you missed it, it's just called Theophany. There's an entire appendix called The Angel of the Lord or The Angel of Yahweh. It's a very extensive appendix that discusses that in detail. So if that's a topic that you're interested in studying more, I would commend that resource to you. What is the significance of God using theophanies to accompany new revelation? It's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, other than to say there's sort of like signposts, sort of like an extra little, pay attention to this. This is important. This is big. Just markers along the way in the redemptive historical plan. Okay, why is it significant that during the ascension, Jesus ascended into the clouds instead of in the flames, as in Judges 13? What does this signify? So I think it signifies that Jesus is returning to his Father in heaven. You know, throughout the scriptures, God is said to dwell in the heavens, and I don't think that that's sort of like a physical or metaphysical place. God exists beyond time and space, so it's in some ways symbolic, but I think that it means that he's taking his place at the Father's right hand, dwelling in glory, waiting for the return when he will come back again. Also, clouds do have sort of a connotation of glory, as well as mystery, hiddenness, obscurity. So there's that there too, symbolically. How do you know you are not going too far off the rails in imagery and motifs? Scripture interprets scripture, right? So if you're studying a passage and you're coming to a conclusion that feels out of sorts with the rest of scripture, that might be a good clue. If it feels resonant, consistent with the rest of the Bible story, then I think you're on a good track.